I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. If you've ever planted a flower garden, you know what it takes. Planting, watering, maybe adding fertilizer and compost, and that never-ending task of weeding. What if there were an easier way to create a beautiful, rewarding garden? There is, says landscape designer Larry Wiener. Wiener argues that many traditional gardening practices are not just time-consuming, they're counterproductive, and they hurt the environment. When we plant species that aren't suited to our local landscape, we set ourselves up for struggle, he says. Instead, the natural processes of native plant communities should guide us. Stop pulling weeds, retire the rototiller, and start a revolution in your garden. It's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us this sultry day. Really sultry. It's really hot. If you have a garden, these days it may be a spot you look out at from inside the AC. We didn't know it would be this steamy when we invited our guest, but it makes for an interesting perspective on what we're going to talk about today. Today's show is about ornamental gardening, but we won't be talking about tulips and daylilies. It's because our guest has a bone to pick with the way most people approach gardening. Larry Wiener is a landscape designer and part of a growing movement in the field, ecological landscape design. These designers aim to design gardens that are sustainable, part of the local ecosystem. If you plant species that are used to the local habitat, the argument goes, they'll thrive, attract wildlife, and provide an entirely deeper reward than an array of cultivated roses. Plus, Larry Wiener argues, they're a lot less work. Here's how he puts it in his new book, Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. Quote, a traditional garden is like a beautiful car with no engine. The body is sleek, the interior is plush, and the stereo sounds great, but the owner will always need to push it up the hills with bags of fertilizer, weeding forks, and watering wands. End quote. If we want our gardens to do that work for us, Wiener says, we need to learn from how plants and wildlife interact in their native ecosystems. Is it really such a sin to choose plants that appeal to us? Well, what's the harm in pulling weeds? And anyway, what possible alternative could there be? How can a home gardener replicate something as complex as an ecosystem? Larry Wiener is here in the studio with me to answer those questions. Welcome to Midday.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Sheila.
I'm very glad you could be with us. I think most of us would consider gardening a pretty benign hobby, but you write that traditional gardening has fallen into harmful habits. Give us an example, or two, or three.
Well, there are different levels, I think, that what is a well-meaning activity can sometimes have non-beneficial side effects. Obviously, overuse of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers can be a source of pollution in the landscape. But there are some things that I think are less obvious, such as there's an ecological term, disturbance, which is basically when a plant community or an ecological system is externally caused to change. When we dig up gardens to double dig to prepare for beds, when we're even pulling weeds by the roots, we're creating a disturbance. And disturbances have side effects. Some of them can be positive. Some of them can be negative. Some of the negative ones can be things like erosion, can be the generation of seed germination, which in our world often creates more weeds, which has a direct relationship to the work of
the garden. I'm sorry. Let me interrupt on that point. I want to hear more of the things that you think are harmful practices. But pulling weeds can generate more weeds?
Yeah, that is one thing you find when you study ecological process is that a lot of what we do in gardening is counterproductive just from a maintenance standpoint. When you pull a weed by the roots, you disturb the soil. An ecologist knows that when soil is disturbed, the rate at which seeds germinate increases dramatically. So when you pull a weed by the roots and disturb the soil, you're generating seed germination. And in our world, most of the seeds that are currently in our soil are weeds. So basically, pulling weeds by the roots is a perpetual, never-ending cycle of weeding. And I would advocate dense ground layer plantings that suppress the germination of weeds and reduce them so that you're avoiding having to disturb the ground and continue this weeding cycle. And when you do get the weeds that come through, which will be decreased from the competition of the ground layer, you cut them at the base underneath that suppressive ground layer. So we are cutting a plant below other plants where it's getting no light and has a difficulty regenerating. And you're not disturbing the soil and creating more weeds.
Well, that's something else that confused me in reading. And I confess I did not read the entire book. I read parts of it. But I think I picked this up from my mom, who would, were she still living, would be so shocked by so much of what you write. But I thought cutting a plant back lets it double down into its root system and makes it hardier.
No, I don't believe that's necessarily the case. If a plant uses resources to grow, now its next job is that growth needs to photosynthesize, create food, and send it to the roots. If it uses that food in the roots to grow and then gets cut off before it has the ability to make food and send it back to the roots, it's wasted energy. And if that process is repeated a couple times, different plants have different ability to withstand these things, but it will expire from the lack of ability to create food. Now, in a typical mulched garden, if the plant is cut back, it will reemerge. And the moment it pushes through the mulch, it's getting sunlight and it is having the ability to create more food, to produce more food and rejuvenate. But if the plant is cut below a dense ground layer, when it reemerges, it doesn't have sunlight.
Let me just make sure that everybody understands. When you say cut below a dense ground layer, you mean a layer of other plants near it.
Correct.
That are taller than it is, and therefore they get the sunlight. And that's this plant you're trying to get rid of.
That's correct.
Which some people would call a weed, is not able to get sunlight to make food.
Right. When it reemerges, it may have to go through 24 inches of dense shade because that's the level of the ground layer to get sun again. It's unlikely to do that. Some weeds will come back, and they may get cut a second time. This is interesting. Some might think I'm crazy for doing an experiment like this, but I wanted to see the relative time it takes to cut a weed at the base versus pull it by the roots. So I just did a little experiment and had a couple people that were doing some work do it individually. And basically what I found is, on average, you can cut four weeds at the base in the same time it takes to pull one weed by the roots. So if you have a dense ground layer that is suppressing most of the weed seed germination anyway, and those few weeds that get through that ground layer are cut instead of pulled, you're basically not disturbing and moving towards another term, which would be called relative ecological stability. That is an ecological term, but in gardening, it means less new plants coming in, which means less weeds.
Well, I must say, on the point about whether it is more, it takes more human effort to pull a weed out by the roots as opposed to cutting it, I think we all knew the answer to that, maybe not with the precision with which you found it, but that's exactly why many of us thought the right way to do it was the hard way to do it, take it out by the roots.
Yeah, and I think that there are many instances of that where you find that really time-worn, what everybody learned, horticultural practices, and they've worked. People have created gardens for years that are beautiful using these practices. However, if we're going to start saying, well, maybe that lawn should be part something else because I don't need it and it's not contributing and it's too much work. Or maybe that woodland that's filled with clogged up vines, maybe I should try to do something with that. That's not garden scale anymore. Now we can't individually weed every plant that we did not plant because the scale is too big. Even if it's a small third of an acre lawn, it's still it's a big garden if you're changing it into something else. So the idea here is the scale is growing. If we really want to do something ecologically beneficial, the more we do it from a square footage standpoint, the more ecologically beneficial it is. And now we've grown out of that garden scale. Now we can't plant every individual plant we want and weed everything else. It's just too big. So now we have to understand the processes that govern vegetation and why this group of plants is thriving and why another group is not, and figure that out intellectually and start applying methods that are very practical such as cutting instead of pulling by the roots, such as cutting plants at a certain time of year may favor certain species and disfavor others. And it becomes this process that you're managing instead of this static composition like a painting on a wall that should never change. These are the plants I picked. This is how I arranged them. And that's the end of the story. That's kind of not what this type of gardening is about. It's about change over time.
That is landscape designer Larry Weiner here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his gorgeous book titled Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. Weiner will be speaking tomorrow evening at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore about his book. Right now, you can be in conversation with him. What do you think when you hear about the idea of basing your garden on native ecosystems? Does this strike you as a good idea? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I interrupted you perhaps before you got through telling us some of what you consider the most harmful practices that many home gardeners engage in.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would almost reiterate the idea of disturbance, the idea of when you go in and prepare a garden, a good gardener brings in some topsoil, if they have a poor soil, or digs compost into that soil. And I'm looking at a different approach. I'm looking at the soil conditions that I have and picking the plants that are particularly adapted to that condition, meaning what kind of habitat is my property similar to, and what are the plants that grow in that specific habitat? And while I'm not limiting myself to only those plants, I'm using those plants as the backbone of the garden. And consequently, looking at the idea of digging the garden, again, the more you disturb and the more you dig, the more you bring up weed seeds. So first of all, the act of double digging a garden is basically increasing the initial weed presence. Why are you double digging? So you can improve the soil. Well, improving the soil is a good thing horticulturally because it allows you to grow a wide variety of plants. Most plants will grow in a nice soil. But most weeds will also grow in a nice soil. So you have a soil that tends to gravelly infertility or a soil that's very poorly drained. There are a lot of weeds that dropped out right off the bat because they don't tolerate those conditions. Not all, but some will. But if you're picking the plants that actually grow in those conditions, and there are beautiful native plants that grow in the extremes, then those plants have the advantage because they're where they want to be. And some weeds will still be present, but they may not grow as vigorously, and some won't appear at all. And you'll still have to deal with the rest. None of this is perfect, and nothing is no maintenance by any means. But by kind of understanding the ecology of what's out there and applying it to your garden specifically, and not over making it wonderful. Wonderful is wonderful for weeds. You can't make it one way and not the other, so to speak.
Well, but you say, I didn't catch exactly the phrase. I can't quote it back to you exactly, but essentially you're saying you need to understand what your soil is or what your climate is, what your ecosystem is. But if it has been cultivated by me or by the people who lived there before me or whoever, it's not what it was originally, whatever that was, you know, decades ago, centuries ago. I mean, how am I supposed to know what its nature is?
Well, that's a very good point. And the first thing to do is try to understand where you are and historically what happened. If you have a little patch of woodland in the back, you may be able to discern just by observing that the soil was never removed or disturbed like it was immediately around your house. So those soil conditions, while it was logged and it was farmed and it was tilled, the actual soil is still in place. And basically what would have grown here, what native species would have grown in this soil type in this place, which is discernible and can be learned from botanical references or going to gardens, nature centers, or really speaking to anyone who understands ecology and biology of your area, you can determine what were the plants that would have grown here in this condition. And your question is very well taken. Are those conditions still existing? If someone brought in new topsoil to build your house, then they're not. So what soil do I have, and what is the habitat that most closely resembles what I now have, which may not be what was originally here? In most cases, in the perimeter areas, it's still the same soil. It's still the same condition to some extent.
We need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with landscape designer Larry Wiener. You can be part of this conversation when he says practices like tilling and fertilizing disturb the local ecology. Gardeners, what do you think when you hear that? Call us. 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking today with landscape designer Larry Wiener. He's co-author of Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. How would you feel about an unpredictable garden? Do you think you'd be as satisfied with a garden that was more self-sustaining? Do you enjoy the constant maintenance of a traditional garden? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Before we go to calls, I want to understand better. If somebody wants to get started on this, how do they get started? What are the first steps?
Really, the first thing I would do, unfortunately, this isn't the kind of thing where if I want to do a certain type of native garden, like a meadow, there's step 1 through 10, which will always apply in every case. It's really a little more analysis than that. So I think the first thing to do is to get a textbook on terrestrial ecology, which is basically how plants operate in nature. If you were a student taking ecology, environmental science 101, what's the textbook they would give you? And just read about things like disturbance and ecological succession, which is the way plants change over time in nature, plant compositions. And just start getting those concepts kind of in your head a little bit. And that really engenders a lot of questions that you might not have thought to ask. And if you don't think to ask the question, you can't answer it. So that would be the first step.
So this may be less physical labor, but you're talking about substituting a fair amount of intellectual labor to understand this process.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I often use the term brains over brawn is what this is about. However, the brain work does need to be done. There needs to be an understanding of ecology. Pretend you're learning a little bit of environmental science, of terrestrial ecology, how plants are working above the ground with each other, against each other. Once you start to understand that, you'll find ideas kind of come to you, things that you look at and commonly, for instance, we talked about weeding. You pull a weed, you don't think about it. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. But if you understand disturbance and you understand the proliferation of plants and the relationship between disturbance and seed germination, all of a sudden you pull a weed and you look at that soil and you say, you know what, I just generated a lot of weeds. That is not deep ecological science. It's environmental science 101.
I'm having a hard time getting my head around it.
But you're bringing it into garden design in a practical way.
Does it make sense to do this like in part of never mind asking what people do. Should people think, I'm going to start a little plot this way and the rest of my yard I'll keep doing as I've been doing it, but I'll kind of ease into this? Or does it make more sense to do this in your domain where you have sway to kind of go whole hog in this direction?
I think easing into it is a good idea because it is very different and because it is easy to mow a lawn. I'm certainly an advocate of reduced lawn, not eliminating lawns, but it is intellectually easy. Someone gets on a mower and mows it. You know, you can have a better lawn or a worse lawn, but at least it's short and it's green. Here we're talking about more understanding and a little deeper knowledge. So I think it's a good idea to try little plots. You know, there's a real simple experiment you can do. Take a plot in your yard, remove the turf or remove the weeds, and just leave it bare soil, a small little spot, and then watch what grows. You know,
so wait a minute. I'm allowed to remove. I'm allowed to dig out the weeds that are there in that plot.
I'm saying start from scratch, bare soil, and just let it happen. Not because that's a landscape you're going to want, but because there will be some good things that come in, some bad things that come in. And if you identify them, that's giving you kind of an idea of what this landscape wants to do on its own. There's kind of four questions that I ask often when I first come to a project or a property or look at it. The first is, if I do nothing, what will happen here? And then the second question is, of that, which plants do I consider desirable and which are undesirable? The third question is, what can I do to move it towards the desirable? And the fourth question is, what can I add that's not likely to happen on its own because I want that to be there? And that's the first question in horticulture. What do I want? It's the last question in this sequence. I'm allowing nature to express itself, interpret it, and then impose what I want on top of that.
Let's turn to Jason, who has called us from Baltimore, who I think is thinking along these same lines. Jason, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. And hi, Larry. Thank you for having the program today. I purchased a house in Baltimore just a few months back. And the previous owner had done a lot of gardening, probably several hundred square feet. And I just wanted to know what your ideas are around maybe taking up the plants that are already there. Like, what would you recommend doing with the plants that are there? I don't want to remove them and have them kill them. So what would you recommend for anything that's, you know, currently there as far as saving the plants or destroying the plants or what?
Jason, thanks for the question. Larry Wiener.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad you asked it because I think some folks might think, you know, because I'm advocating the use of native plants and understanding ecology, that I think there's something wrong with not native plants, and I don't. And I certainly don't think that someone needs to come in and remove all non-native plants in their landscape and convert it to native plants. What I do think is there's no reason not to have non-native plants unless they happen to be particularly invasive species. The majority of non-native plants are not invasive. What I think is important is to have a significant component of native plants in your landscape, not destroy all of the non-native plants. So, you know, which ones stay and which ones go is a common question that I have in the landscape. And it usually comes down to, when it comes to those plants, aesthetics. The point is, if you're intending to keep bees, you want a diversity of native species there. So it's not so important what you remove. It's, I think, important what you add.
Jason, thanks for the call. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Larry Wiener, a landscape designer who incorporates environmental science into his designs. He's co-author of a beautiful new book called Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. And you're welcome to join this conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or a phone call to 410-662-8780. You were just talking about invasives, and Renee has called us from Towson with a question about invasives. Renee, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks. I love the topic, and I'm definitely getting the book. So my first comment was about letting the garden be on its own, and I totally agree with the conversation in terms of building the garden so it can take care of itself, because you only have so much time. And I've certainly done that and seen the benefit over time in terms of planning my garden and thinking about what it'll look like 4 years from now or 5 years from now, instead of just the immediate gratification of seeing something beautiful. But I do have a question in regards to cutting versus pulling for your guests. For invasive plants like morning glory, for example, which is all over my yard, and I can't seem, you know, I pull it, and of course it comes back. I just can't seem to get rid of it. Should I be cutting that instead of pulling it? Or for the other invasive plants that I might find, are there better ways to manage them so that there's not as much upkeep?
Yes.
Renee, thanks for that question.
I think the best way to manage it is to establish a competitive ground layer that is able to diminish the vigor of that plant through competition. Now, that said, because you need to get to that point, and in the meantime, there are plants that are particularly pernicious that I would say should be pulled. Or there's another method here, which is a use of herbicide. However, the use of herbicide can be very different approaches to it. And in the case of what I would call wick applying or painting it, literally painting it on the leaves of the plant, is not really, in my view, in any significant way getting it into the environment. But it's in avoiding disturbance of the soil, and just directly applying it to the leaves is another way. If you don't want to do that, then there are times, and there are a few exceptions, where, such as mugwort or morning glory, like you mentioned, where you do want to get in there and pull it by the roots because the plant's just too vigorous and it will come back.
But you also mentioned planting something else to compete with it, right?
That's the key. The foundation of this is always a dense ground layer.
And so what in this, I mean, you know this neck of the woods, you kind of have a sense of what the climate is like here. What do you think would be a likely plant for Renee to look at to try to compete with the morning glory?
Right. Well, some of the really dense ground layer plants, some of the ferns, New York fern that spread relatively aggressively, golden ground cell is a beautiful spring blooming wildflower that forms a glossy, beautiful ground cover and is a very weed suppressive plant. But it also is very attractive, both flowers and foliage. And the idea of combining things like the fern and the golden ground cell together. In nature, often it's not one plant occupying one place. Even a short woodland ground layer or a meadow can have layers. And there's ground creeping plants, there's bushy plants in the middle, and there may be tall umbrella-shaped plants at the upper level. That's three layers for a weed to get through. So a multi-layered ground-level planting reduces the amount of the weeds to start with. Once you get there, then it becomes very easy, and then you can start cutting underneath.
Barbara, I think, wants to discuss herbicides with you. Barbara is calling us from Towson. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I am also having trouble wrapping my head around this, but we have a stretch along the back of our yard where we had a stand of evergreens that have all gotten a disease and died, 13 of them. They were 60 feet high.
Oh, my.
And because now the sunlight is getting in there, there's just this rampant growth of weeds that it seems no matter what I do, I've tried cutting them, I've tried painting them, because I don't like to spray herbicide. We're really happy that, you know, we've got toads and all kinds of little creatures hopping around because we don't use the poisons, but I can't figure out how to try and manage this. As soon as I cut everything down, paint it, the little bits that are left, then it just comes back just as strong. 2 weeks later, it looks just like it did after I worked all day. Well, any ideas?
Barbara, thanks for that question.
Well, I would love to give you the easy answer or a magic bullet for this. However, what this really is about is looking at the plants that are regenerating, determining are there desirable plants in there? Obviously, there are undesirable plants in there, making sure you save the ones that may be desirable. But really, it's about understanding the weeds, the specific weeds that you're trying to eliminate, and whether you're using chemicals or whether you're using some kind of a manual method, understand the plant and exploit its weaknesses. Certain plants, most weeds grow in the spring, for instance, and many of the native grasses that we would manage for in a sunny landscape, like little bluestem, which is a beautiful native grass, primarily grow in the summer and not in the spring. And so in a situation like what you have, and I don't know what plants are coming in, you could have over time a mix of weedy plants and, let's say, little bluestem. It naturally occurs, particularly in dry, infertile areas. So if you identify that plant as a potential plant that could dominate your landscape on its own, and you mowed that landscape in the spring but never in the warm summer, you would be only cutting the weeds because they grow in the spring. But at that time of year, the grass, the native grass, is not actively growing, so you wouldn't be cutting the grass. Then you stop mowing in the summer, and the grass is in its growth period, so it's not getting cut. But the weeds primarily grow in the spring, so they don't come back as strong. So while this doesn't change the composition in the day you went out there and did it, if that is repeated over time, you would be favoring these warm season native grasses over the particular weeds you have, which most of which are cool season growers. And basically, you will have been understanding the ecological proclivities of the plants you're managing for and against and exploiting that difference. These things take time, and it's not necessarily what you would do at the front door of your house, but out in the perimeter where some conifers died and it's bigger than you want to plant as a garden, this kind of approach can be very beneficial.
Barbara, I appreciate that question. I must say, as I listen to you respond to her, I'm thinking of the kinds of questions I asked as a kid. Why is that a weed? I mean, is it clear to you, as you work on for different clients in different places, what's a weed and what is just a native plant that's asserting itself?
Well, the old-fashioned horticultural answer is a weed is a plant you don't want.
Okay.
And I think that's still valid. There are plants that I would consider a weed in this landscape because it's aggressive and it will overrun the scale of a small little plot, whereas I may have a 10-acre field and that plant is fine with me in a 10-acre field because it's a native plant and it is aggressive and it will help suppress the weeds. So, and there are certain plants which I will almost always consider a weed, such as mugwort or Canada thistle. These are plants that, are causing problems in the landscape, so I would never identify them not as such. But really, it's about what you're trying to accomplish in the landscape and does
that
plant fit.
So weed is in the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely.
And speaking of 10-acre plots, I mentioned how beautiful this book is, but most of the photos look like gardens on large estates. Who is the target audience for what you're talking about?
Yeah, my target audience is absolutely not only large estates or even middle-sized properties. I live in less than a third of an acre, an inner-ring suburb adjacent to the city of Philadelphia, and I'm practicing everything in my book in spades, and it's very small and have been for over 25 years there. But this is a very small, close-to-urban property, so I don't think that it's oriented that way at all. The funny thing is, when I give lectures, I intentionally try to mix in small properties because we work on them frequently too. But what people seem to always remember are the big ones. So I can't seem to overcome that one. But as did you.
We need to take another quick break. And when we come back, more about how home gardeners can use natural processes to transform the way they garden. Join our conversation. Why do you garden? What are you aiming for when you pick up a trowel and a watering can? What makes you happy in that? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. We'll talk to callers when we get back. I'm Sheila Cast. We will be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Larry Weiner, co-author of Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. In his work, he combines ecological restoration with traditional garden design. And you can be part of this conversation. What would your neighbors think if you fostered a revolution in your garden? Think they'd go for it? Email us at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Our listeners may be familiar with the USDA's Plant Hardiness Zone map. It's a tool for figuring out which plants are likely to thrive. But you recommend using something called an ecoregion instead. What is an ecoregion?
You can find easily online maps of the ecoregions of the United States. And kind of similar to the political borders, Georgia, Alabama, Pennsylvania, it's basically a map of the United States, and it locates the borders of the various ecoregions, meaning the different types of regions where different specific habitat types occur. For instance, there's the one ecoregion would be the Atlantic coastal plain, and there's an inner coastal plain and an outer coastal plain. Of course, the Piedmont occurs in Maryland. So these are ecoregions, and they're very useful. Sometimes folks think about, okay, if I want to use native plants, I will use plants, and I live in Maryland, I will use plants that are native to Maryland. But plants are not particularly interested in state boundaries. They're more interested in the environmental type that they're occurring in. So the ecoregion map is really what tells you whether a plant is native to where you are or not. And, of course, there's a coastal plain in Maryland, and there's a Piedmont ecoregion in Maryland. They're very, very different soil types, topography, hydrology. So really what you want to know is what ecoregion am I in and what are the plants that are native to that ecoregion.
Bill is calling us from Baltimore. Bill, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I just wanted to make sure I remind everyone that Maryland and the Mid-Atlantic region lost over, for the last 3 years, 60% of all the managed honeybee colonies. And this is due in large part to the synthetic chemicals and stuff that we use in our yards. Americans use well over 100 million pounds of pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides on their yards and lawns. And this is not accounting for the synthetic fertilizers. All of these compounds end up running off of our yards, running into our streams and rivers, and eventually out into the Chesapeake Bay or any of these river outlets, the Mississippi River, down into the Gulf, creating all kinds of havoc in our waterways. The other thing I'd like to say is gardening is a participation sport. You can't expect to just go out and plant something and suddenly have just, you know, acres upon acres of beautiful flowers and stuff. You have to go out there and work your stuff. And one last very important point I'd like to make is...
Why don't I... let me let Larry Wiener respond to the points that you've made so far. What is there something you'd like to say either about the effect on bees or Bill's last point about you have to expect to work?
Yeah, both are very valid points. And on your first point regarding the problem with pesticides and their, you know, effect on bee populations, which is obviously very significant. On the positive end, again, diversity of flowering species is really key to giving them the habitat that they want. So you can come at it from the reducing the negative and reducing the pesticides that are being used, and also come at it from the positive, which is putting the plants out there that they also need to survive. And you're absolutely right. Anyone who comes away from either my book, and I don't think you would if you read the book, with the idea that this type of approach requires no work, that's absolutely not true. There's no such thing as a no-maintenance garden. In fact, I once spoke to a fellow who had AstroTurf in his backyard, and he had just spent $300 to steam clean it. So even AstroTurf is not no-maintenance. There's no such thing. So that's a very good point.
Kathy is calling us from Baltimore. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi. Looking forward to meeting you tomorrow night at the Ivy, but today I was out watering, and I have an awful lot of Vinca minor in a shady area, and I was envisioning some sort of shade-loving grasses. What is your favorite native shade-loving grass?
Well, my favorite native shade-loving grass, I would say, is bottlebrush grass, Hystrix patula, and it's really got a beautiful flower and seed head. However, most of the native grasses are sun-loving plants. Hystrix is a bottlebrush grass is an exception. But the grass-like plants, the sedges, which are not true botanical grasses but are very similar to sedge, like Pennsylvania sedge and Appalachian sedge, there is a whole host of them. They form beautiful ground covers in woodlands, and some of them tolerate very acidic conditions in deep shade, dry shade, more moist shade. So you want to pick the right sedge for your condition. But I would really look in the sedge family, very underused group of plants.
Kathy, thanks for that question. Zaki from Martinsburg, West Virginia, has a question. Zaki, welcome to Midday.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I just want to tell you, you really made my day because I will never strong arm another weed again in life. But my question is about my lawn. I have a lot of sustainable farming friends out here, and they're constantly encouraging me to, you know, get rid of my lawn. And they've said that I could let a form of clover overgrow the lawn. So I just want to know what you would recommend for something low-growing that I could keep throwing seed into the lawn to eventually take over it.
Yeah, I mean, the suggestion of clover is an interesting one because allowing clover to overtake the lawn or planting clover as a replacement would be a major improvement on a lot of standpoints from an ecological standpoint over the lawn. You wouldn't be mowing it as frequently. You would be providing the flowers of the clover. Talking about pollinators are good for the pollinators. So that's a viable strategy. My proclivity in general would be to use some of the native grasses. Again, the previous questioner asked about native grasses. There are some really beautiful native grasses that wouldn't be mowed like turf. Depending on the species you picked, it might be anywhere from 12 inches to 18 or 24 inches tall. But little blue stem is a wonderful grass for dry conditions, and purple top, and there are all kinds of really nice native grasses that you would mow much more infrequently than lawn, or maybe even once a year.
Zaki, thank you for that question. Judging from our emailers, there is an English ivy epidemic around us. Katie wrote, I am having lots of issues trying to rid the English ivy from around the house and in my 1/2 acre woods. Will cutting English ivy to the soil level work? Charlotte wrote, English ivy, how to get rid of it? I cut from trees, pull from ground, and when it goes vertical, birds spread seeds. So I pull seedlings, which grow in the lawn. Mowing does nothing.
Well, cutting English ivy, as I described, is the cut instead of pull by the roots weeds. In the situation you're talking about, if you mow down to nothing all of that English ivy, there is no competing plants around it. So when it resprouts, it gets light right away. So you don't have the condition yet that engenders the cut, not pull method. Unless you cut the ivy so frequently that it never has a significant amount of time where it has foliage and does not photosynthesize at all. Any plant will starve to death if it doesn't have leaves to produce food. But that requires frequent cutting over possibly a fairly long period of time. And in that case, again, when you're starting with a composition that is largely undesirable and there's not competition around it, it's either remove. You do have to remove by the roots to get rid of it, basically, or cutting very frequently over possibly a year.
Mike has a similar question. Mike, calling us from Baldwin, welcome to the show. Mike,
yeah, I was calling about poison ivy and poison oak. How would you go about getting rid of that, especially when you're trying to reclaim some of your areas and you find out all of a sudden that you've got poison ivy and poison oak growing?
Mike, thanks for that question.
Yeah, and it really depends on the scale. How big an area are you working? But again, I think it comes down to the idea you can't do this over 40 acres of woodlands, but in a fairly small plot, the idea of painting herbicide on leaves can be very useful. Now, if there's too many plants to practically do that, then again, the mowing strategy can be very interesting. I mentioned before, poison ivy primarily is putting out its growth in the spring. So if you cut it in the spring, particularly if it's a sunny area, and there's a potential for native warm season grasses, you might be favoring those grasses to come in. But this is the kind of thing that would happen over time and be very frequent, so to speak, frequent cutting.
So part of a decision a gardener has to make then, if I'm following this correctly, is if you see there's something you need to get rid of, like poison ivy or English ivy, figuring out when what you'd like to be there instead, what you'd like to plant to compete, when its favorite growing season is, and timing your whole competition loading to when that new plant is going to thrive?
That's correct. And not only what condition that new plant wants, but what conditions the plant you're managing against don't want. And you kind of intimated planting time, and you know that triggered a very useful thought again with the spring. If you're planting warm season grass by seed, and you plant it at the end of spring or at the beginning of summer, you're planting it right when that plant is adapted to grow. But you've planted it at the end of the season that most of the weeds grow, which is in the spring, giving that grass a head start. So basically, would the grass be happier being planted in the spring in a vacuum? Possibly. It might get more moisture and germinate a little better. But by placing the planting date at the end of spring, you are considering its competitors and you're giving it an advantage.
Our time grows short, but I think we can take a minute to ask Jackie what she's calling about. Jackie from Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so glad I'm getting the opportunity to talk to you. I'm a master gardener and a mostly self-educated gardener. I'm doing what most of the things that you're talking about in your book, and I'm trying to proselytize to the folks on my street or people that I know. A couple of caveats and problems. Let me back up. People are calling in to ask you questions because they have the opportunity. Many, many people don't understand that there are all kinds of resources in addition to or after they've finished reading your books. So I think it's vital that you mention the resources that are available in most communities. In Baltimore, we're very lucky because we have a fabulous extension service. There are master gardeners. I trained in Baltimore City, but I believe that the Baltimore County Master Gardener Program is very fabulous. So access to further information or access to somebody who might even come over to my house and identify the weeds that I might have, or helping people grow a little bit. I'm going to say one more thing. Maryland now has the first state-mandated ecological literacy program required for students. I don't know what's in that program, but the average person on the street doesn't know what a leaf is for.
Jackie, I appreciate your calling. As I said, our time has grown short. Do you have a quick response to Jackie?
Sure, just a couple quick ones. BONAP, B-O-N-A-P, is a website that gives you extensive information on ecological plant communities and specific species that are in them.
B as in boy, O-N as in Nancy, A-P as in Paul?
That is correct. And go to your local nature centers and ask about talking to botanists and ecologists.
Jackie, I appreciate your calling. We've got more callers and more emailers, but let me just ask this real quick question from Daniel. Soil schmoil. My choice of planting is limited to what the deer won't eat.
Of course, deer are a huge problem when planting landscapes. And there's really three categories of plants. One would be trees. When we're planting trees, we make sure that the lowest branch is over 4 feet tall, which is above their reach. And in the fall, you wrap the trunks to prevent buck grub. But perennials, and that's common knowledge, but perennials, we have maybe a little different take. If a deer sees a plant, they like it in your garden, they taste it, they eat it, and it's gone. However, I've noticed in meadows that deer will not eat plants that they like if they are intermingled with other things that they don't necessarily like.
So much more to talk about. I wish we had more time. I really have enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be here, Sheila.
Larry Weiner. He is co-author of Garden Revolution, How Our Landscapes Can Be a Source of Environmental Change. He'll be at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in Baltimore for a discussion and book signing tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. There's a link to the event on the midday page at WYPR.org. Also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Part of the passion running through this year's election campaign is a sense that those who have it all have it made are again ignoring those who are struggling, people sometimes described as crackers, rednecks, or white trash. We'll speak with the author of A History of White Trash. I'm Sheila Kasten. Have a great afternoon. Stay cool.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.